Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Dr. Christian Northrup. Dr. Christian Northrup is a visionary pioneer in women's health, a board-certified OBGYN, and the multiple New York Times best-selling author of Women's Bodies, Women's Wisdom, Goddesses Never Age, Dodging Energy Vampires, and many other fabulous books. In 2013, Reader's Digest named Dr. Northrup one of the 100 most trusted people in America. And in 2016, she was named one of Oprah Winfrey's Super Soul 100, a group of leaders who are using their voices and talents to awaken humanity. Dr. Northrup has hosted 8 highly successful public television specials, and her work has been featured on The Oprah Winfrey Show, The Today Show, NBC Nightly News, The View, Rachel Ray, Good Morning America, 2020, The Dr. Oz Show, and many other programs. So now, Christian, my dad and I are so grateful to you for your brilliant, courageous, heartful work, and we're so glad to have this time with you. And now for this interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad and colleague, John Robbins.
Well, thank you, Ocean, for that splendid introduction. And thank you, Christian, for being with us again. Christian, doctors typically have been trained to become experts in what can go wrong with our bodies. You said, though, that you have developed expertise in knowing what can go right with our bodies. Christian, what's the significance of that distinction, and why do you say that?
Well, the Women's Health Board certification that I hold is I've become board certified in everything that can possibly go wrong with a female body and how to fix it. But what if we started far upstream and we spent equal time, probably more, teaching women how to stay healthy and how to make everything that can go right with their bodies the primary experience? People are brainwashed into thinking that you need to go check every year at least to make sure things are on track. So therefore, women's health has become disease screening. Oh, I was given a clean bill of health, so I don't have to go back for a year. Oh, I'm 50. It's time for my colonoscopy. It's time for yearly mammograms. It's time because the profession is based on inevitable decline and deterioration, especially if you don't continually monitor it from tests outside of your own knowledge.
When you talk about disease screening, it's as though that's what prevention has come to mean. Meanwhile, the companies that produce our food have little or no interest in our health, while most of the physicians who look after our health have little or no interest in our food. Not that it's their fault. Most doctors have learned absolutely nothing about the power of food to heal or to harm. In fact, a Harvard doctor once told me, if food was medicine, he said, I would have learned about it in medical school.
He really said that?
He did.
Oh, God. My Aunt Harriet, who is a pediatrician, gave me a book when I went to medical school called The Nuts Among the Berries. She wanted me to know that I was a card-carrying member of the Health Nut group because I was raised on organic food and we had a compost heap and my dad, who was a dentist, took homemade yogurt to his patients who were on antibiotics. So I grew up from a very early age understanding the power of food. And then I would sit in with Michio Kushi of the East-West Foundation in Boston while he would do what was called oriental diagnosis on cancer patients for whom the medical system had been a dismal failure. They'd come in with these, 6-inch thick charts, been given up for dead. And I watched what happened to their health, to their face, to their life when they began eating healthy food. So, and to this day, medical students are taught nothing about nutrition. And let's be very clear, the conventional medical world is simply an extension of big pharma at this particular time. I mean, all of the medical literature is pretty much put in place, kept in place by big pharma, and people need to know that. There, like you said, there is no incentive to learn about food. I mean, do you think that the organic carrot producers are going to make enough money to support a medical school? No.
Well, and that leaves us then only treating disease after it's happened. And it seems to me that treating a person after she's already sick is a little like digging a well when a person is already thirsty.
Yes, we need to fix the fences. We continually are trying to get the horses back in the barn, but we don't fix the fences. So the horses keep getting out. That's how it is. And until people wake up to their own power to fix their own fences, nothing will change. And I do believe that we are at a particular turning point, a tipping point, a crisis point, as it were. If you just look at, and I just listened to a medical economist speak about the autism epidemic and that it would be costing the United States trillions of dollars to take care of these people who are now becoming adults, because one in 40 people now has autism. And it's interesting how we look everywhere, but where we need to be looking, which is the environmental toxins and so on that we inject or we ingest or in the air, in the water, this kind of thing. It's time that we need to take a look at, why is this happening? It's not because people are not taking enough drugs or they're not going to the doctor often enough. 54% of American children have a chronic illness. We really need to wake up as a culture, take a look.
You mentioned environmental pollutants and toxins, and there are a lot of them in our world today, and there's a lot of concern about them, rightly so. And some of them can and do harm us. Some of them are endocrine disruptors, and many people are doing whatever they can to reduce their exposures, and I support them in doing that. And you've said, though, that the number one hormone disruptor is actually the sugar we consume.
That is absolutely true. In fact, it's so stunning. You know, you see all these articles, how to balance your hormones. Well, here's the thing. Let me give it to you in a nutshell. When you eat high glycemic foods, that's foods that raise the blood sugar quickly. That's basically all junk food. It's all the foods in the middle aisle of the grocery store, not around the perimeter. So when you eat a food that raises the blood sugar quickly, like anything made with white flour and sugar, then what happens is insulin levels rise. And when insulin levels rise, they change the way that the sex steroids are metabolized, so that in the face of excess insulin, then estrogen, progesterone, testosterone all go down a metabolic pathway where they become catechol estrogens. That is, estrogens that have a characteristic of a stress hormone, cortisol. And then in the face of cortisol from stress, oh my God, you know, I'm too fat, there's a tie around my middle, anything like that, then it kind of compounds the whole situation. So I kind of call it the Bermuda Triangle of excess sugar, excess stress, excess fat, and around and around and around we go.
And we do, and we get rounder and rounder and rounder. As
yes, we do.
Yeah. The average American today is eating 141 pounds of sweeteners every year. And I know that I don't eat very much, so some people are eating double that. I mean, they're eating more than their weight in added sugar every year, and that includes about 45 pounds of corn syrup. Kristen, I can't help but think that big food has deliberately created highly addictive, so-called convenience foods that are designed to raise our dopamine levels.
That is exactly right. And we know that. We know that even your social media, the likes on your Facebook page or Instagram, are created to give you a hit of dopamine, which is addictive. So the more you're addicted to your social media or your computer, then the less exercise you're getting. And then the more you are eating junk food, because we know so-called comfort foods, right? Why are they comfort foods? Because they raise our beta endorphin levels, the sugar. We know those studies, you know, where they put rats' paws on a hot plate. And if the rats had been eating sugar, the sugar was kind of an opioid. It dulled pain. And so the rats could keep their paws on a hot plate longer. Well, in a way, we're all rats, especially if you're tuned into the mainstream media, kind of designed to keep you afraid or keep you angry and then keep you eating more sugar to feel better. And again, around and around it goes.
Well, in the face of all that, that is so intractable. It's so powerful. The momentum behind it is so intense in our culture. So many people, so many women in particular, are just at the mercy of that, and there's no mercy in it. What gives you strength to continue, Christian? And what motivates you to do what you do?
I love that question. I really do, because I'm feeling it so strongly these days. It feels as though we are reaching critical mass. I was in Chile last year with Alberto Velodo, who runs the Four Winds Society and teaches shamanism. And he said, we're in the sixth great extinction on our planet. And when there's an extinction event, and we know how many species are becoming extinct and so on, there is evolutionary pressure that comes to bear, and it literally creates new species. And he said the new species that we are creating is Homo luminous, energy-based, light-based humans. And so I believe that this pressure from, I call it darkness with a capital D, that would be the forces to keep us chained to our televisions, to our medications, to all of that. They're becoming so blatant that it is forcing us to lighten up and to not feed darkness. How do we feed darkness? We feed it with our fear and our anger. So despite what you're seeing, when we hold a high frequency, and a friend of mine calls it a freedom frequency, when we hold that high frequency, then everyone around us tends to entrain to the high frequency. If you look on YouTube, and everyone should just go watch, you can see these metronomes, YouTube metronomes. And if you start them off at all different ticking speeds, within a couple minutes, they're all ticking at the same rate. It's the most amazing thing that suddenly everything is entrained. So even by listening to you, to the Food Revolution Summit, we are setting a high vibration, and humans will naturally entrain to the highest vibration. And that's how we're going to do this. And luckily, it isn't going to take much more than a critical mass. I think it's when they did the experiments with transcendental meditation that changed the number of terrorist attacks, the number of accidents, the number of violence. It only took 1% of the population with a high vibration to change everybody, because light is far more powerful than anger and fear and darkness.
A lot of us have had our frequencies pushed down to a lower level when we're children, because we'll do whatever it takes to fit in. And we want to belong so badly, we need to belong, that we will shut off huge parts of ourselves if that seems to be what's needed. And then as adults, as we get older, some of us will find that fitting in for its own sake just isn't that interesting anymore. And it's more important now to raise our frequency.
This is very funny that you should bring this up. My daughter has always wanted to be, she got the Good Citizens Award twice in middle school. You know, she was the one that everybody wanted to be around, and she's an extreme extrovert and wanted to take her girlfriends on her honeymoon, that kind of thing. And she realized that there were some unpopular things that she finally needed to say something about. She realized, wait a minute, I cannot let my fear of offending someone keep me from speaking my truth as long as I do it with understanding and love. And she found that so strengthening. And obviously, as my daughter, she has grown up. She used to say to me, why can't you be like the other mothers? You know, like, why are you, you know this one. Yes. Why can't we be like the mainstream parents? And the truth is, because that's not what we were born to do. And what happens, and I see that with you and your son, me and my daughters, when you and I have been true to ourselves and we have been pioneers who went against the grain and held steady, then what happens is we provide inspiration for others. So in my daughter's case, with her peers of 30-somethings and young mothers and so on, they've said to her, thank you for having the courage to speak up, because you've given me courage now. And I think that's what is happening, is that one after another of us, when we stand up for good food, for regenerative farming practices, for organic food, for local farms, and so on, it becomes a positive addiction. The more you do it, the more you want to do it, because when we are around like-minded people, let's say at the farmer's market or something, it's so joyous. I remember being at the farmer's market in Santa Barbara, and there's just something so celebratory about meeting the person who creates these amazing mushrooms or the beautiful avocados or the strawberries. It's this celebration of the earth. And what happens with that is so much oxytocin and prolactin are produced in your body, these bonding hormones that increase love and increase cardiac coherence. And then you're more connected with the earth and with each other. And I think that's where we're going.
Well, it's where I want us to go for sure. And a lot of us are pushing in that direction or being pulled in that direction, being called in that direction. And it's also the case that when people begin to adopt healthier habits, they're bound to have friends or coworkers or family members who will sabotage their efforts or try to. A friend of mine was trying to change her diet to a much healthier one. She had a medical issue, and she was really trying to address it seriously. And her housemate apparently found this threatening because she would offer my friend a piece of cake repeatedly saying, "Be a good girl and have some cake," while practically shoving it into her mouth. Christian, what advice can you give to help us deal when we're confronted with reactions like my friend was from her housemate?
You know, that is such a common situation. You remember back in the old days when I was a young doctor and macrobiotic, so we were vegan with maybe a little fish now and again, people would come over to me at restaurants to see what I was eating. And then when you would, and many of my patients would go home for the holidays, and their parents would make a roast, you know, like, "Well, why aren't you eating what we're having?" And they would be shamed and so on. The key there is to stay in a high vibration of love. And first, we need to understand the sabotage. What is the sabotage for? The purpose of the sabotage is the person who's offering you the cake or the roast is, chances are, feeling possibly like maybe they should be doing what you're doing, but they don't want to do it. And if they could possibly get you to come back where they are, they would feel better about themselves. Now, Dr. Mario Martinez points out that all tribes wound their members in very specific ways to keep them in line. And it has to do with, when we lived in small groups, there would be a fence around the enclosure called a pale. And you've heard the term beyond the pale. And the tribe said, "We will protect you only if you stay within the pale, within the fence." Well, the fence gets internalized in us, right? And we wound our members who step out by three archetypal wounds: betrayal, abandonment, and shaming. So that's just what all groups do. If you step outside, then they will betray you, they will abandon you, or they will shame you. And you know this probably better than anybody because of your background. So there are, as Dr. Martinez says, there are healing fields for these things. So with shame, when you've been shamed, you think about all the things that you've done that are honorable. So the healing field for shame is honor. The healing field for abandonment is commitment. Where have you stayed where you've really committed to someone? And the healing field for betrayal is loyalty. So all the times when someone is betraying you, abandoning you, shaming you, you go into how it feels in your body to be honorable, to be committed, to be loyal. And it may be that you're honoring your own choices, you're committing to your own healing, you're staying loyal to your own path. And when you do this, you set up that high vibration that becomes irresistible. My daughter was at a meeting over Christmas and, you know, a kind of a self-help meeting. And someone was saying, "Well, you know, when God closes a door or a window, he opens another door." And this woman says, "Yeah, but it's those damn hallways that are hell." And so when we are choosing ourselves, when we're loyal to ourselves, committed to ourselves, honoring ourselves first, there's a time, and it's a painful time, when you're alone. You may well be alone, and that's when we must build our faith And then suddenly, other people are going to come in and support us. And we'll find that we have a whole new group of people who are supporting us. And then we're no longer alone, because we're herd creatures. We humans are herd creatures. And you mentioned earlier how difficult it is to be a young person and be different, because we need each other to survive. So our job, I believe, is to find each other. And programs such as yours allow us to find each other.
Well, we're hoping that lots of people will find kindred spirits and people who are in alignment with their hearts and reflect their highest potential and entrain with their higher frequencies, so that we can be clear in ourselves, so we can have clear minds and clear hearts and clear actions and love each other well. If someone is having a difficult relationship with food, might it be helpful for them to take, say, a few weeks, and during that time to write down everything they eat and include where they ate it, what time it was, who they were with, how they were feeling at the time, as much information as they can to understand fully, to be aware fully, to be as conscious as they can about what is in fact their emotional eating?
There is definitely a place for this. And you know, there's a continuum. So there are those who are absolutely addicted. So one little cookie, right, leads to eating the whole box. One bite of ice cream, you don't sort of come up for air or taste anything until the pint is gone. And that's why there's this thing called bright line eating. That's for people who are true food addicts. And there is a time and a place for that if you are totally out of control with food. What you're suggesting is equally valid if someone will do it. But I think making that connection, the old, you know, what's eating you, not what you're eating, but what's eating you. The problem with that is if you are in a food coma, if you're drunk, as it were, then you're not going to have the wherewithal to make those connections. A very nice way to go about this, David Ludwig, you probably know his work at Boston Children's Hospital, and he has a book called Always Hungry, and he's done an enormous amount of work on the hormonal aspects of eating. And what he has people do is a two-week time of induction where you're not on any sugar whatsoever, not even stevia, not even monk fruit, no artificial sweeteners, or even the healthy natural ones. And after 2 weeks, your taste buds get trained differently, and eating a peach is like eating a hot fudge sundae. You will reset your metabolism. So I do believe there is a time and a place for bringing mindfulness in. And then the kind of postdoctoral level is when you can have a cookie and one cookie takes care of it. You don't need any more.
Well, that's the postdoctoral level. A lot of women in particular have trouble with some of these things. And you've written that regardless of how a woman might feel right now, the first step toward optimal health is deciding to respect the body that she has. Christiane, it's a big stretch for a lot of women to love their bodies. I saw a survey recently that found that American women and girls receive an average of 40 negative messages a day about their bodies. How does a woman of any age learn to talk to her body and to talk about her body with compassion and with respect rather than with frustration or disappointment?
You know, years ago, Gay Hendricks wrote a book called How to Love Yourself. And it is as relevant today as it ever was. And what he would suggest is that, and this is a kind of a paradox, that you look in the mirror and you say, either, I love you, looking right into your eyes, I love you, I really love you. And then when the committee in your head says, how can you possibly love this fat ass, or, you know, this cellulite on my thighs, or you're a fat pig, or any of the messages that have been downloaded, then what you do is you love yourself for those feelings, because all a feeling wants is to be heard, is to be felt. Spiritual teacher Matt Kahn suggests something that's also fun, which is when you are berating yourself for saying, I accept you, I love you, when you're berating yourself, then you start cheerleading the part that's berating yourself. And you say, oh my gosh, nobody, nobody on earth has been this good at body trashing. I get the Olympic gold medal for being the body trasher of all time. And what happens when you do that is you start to laugh because it's funny. It's funny. And then when you can laugh at something, then you've lightened the energy around it. And then slowly but surely, by the way, it takes about 30 days of looking in the mirror. I used to give out on a prescription pad the phrase, I accept myself unconditionally right now. I'd write that down, and then I would put, say this once a day out loud, and tell people to tape it on their mirror. And after 30 days, something changes. Our inner being, our soul, as it were, starts to look back at us when we're looking into our own eyes. And then the self-love starts to show up. And then you follow a good diet. Not because you're being good, not because you're depriving yourself, but because something inside says, thank you. This is the food that I have been looking for.
Well, when you say looking into the bathroom mirror and looking into your own eyes and saying, I accept myself unconditionally, I'm thinking about that bathroom mirror. And for many women, it's the number they see on the bathroom scale that can completely dictate how they feel about themselves.
That's right. So what you should do with that, okay, this took me years. So let me give you my trajectory personally. Yes, my day was determined by the number on the scale for decades, maybe for 4 or 5 decades, until finally I realized how insane that was. How insane. It was like a constant external monitor of my worth was the number on the scale. And so I eventually, I think just 2 years ago, finally threw out the scale because I saw that it was, it was a terrorist for me. And I don't intend to step back on the scale until I can do so. And the number on the scale means nothing to me. And I'm not there yet. So instead, I just go by how my clothes fit. And the truth of the matter is, you know, when you're basically eating well or you're doing some intermittent fasting, which I do, which is, you know, no food from dinner till the next day at, you know, 10 or 11 in the morning. So I always have a period where I know my insulin levels go to zero and the body starts to burn fat. So that kind of works to maintain and everything stays the same. But I no longer let that scale determine the quality of my day because I realized that training was just too big for me to overcome. I mean, I personally cannot get on the scale without a lot of judgment because I spent so many years thinking that I weighed too much. You know, when I was 17, I read there was a magazine called 17 Magazine, and it said someone who was 5'2 should weigh 115. Well, I never had the bone structure for that. And I remember being weighed in gym class when I was 13, and I was 125, and I was the heaviest person in class because of my dense body mass. And I realized much, much later that these weight and height charts were ridiculous. Now, of course, we have many, many, many people who are clinically obese, and my 125 frame in eighth grade was perfectly normal, but that's not how I was brought up. So therefore, the tyranny of the scale has not been lost on me, and so I just keep that weapon of mass destruction outside of my realm at the moment.
I've heard women tell other women that you can never be too thin. I realize as a man that I'm not subjected to nearly as much pressure about my appearance as women are. And I see that women's bodies and their weights are often the barometers by which society measures how good you are, how attractive you are, even how worthy you are.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Then we look at the Super Bowl performance of 2020, and we had Shakira and J-Lo. And like you said, there's no man, no male performer who needs to come out in a G-string with his entire body revealed, even if it's in a body stocking, in order to keep his job. I mean, you know, the guys in the Super Bowl could wear these baggy pants and hoodies and so on, and they're fine. We don't know whether they have a six-pack or not. The women have to have an almost perfect body. So there's no question that women are expected to achieve a rate of perfection that's unbelievable. However, having said that, that is true. However, what you realize in your life is that the number on the scale, your weight, whether you're a size 8 or a size 12, at the end of the day, it doesn't make you any happier. You know, those 10 pounds either way, it really doesn't make you any happier. So the deal is, and this is not easy, but the deal is to love your body as much as you possibly can, because that's the key to getting it to a size and shape that is reasonable. And I mean reasonable. I don't know what reasonable is at this point. I think we've gone, frankly, and this is not going to win me any friends, but I think that we have gone overboard with the size acceptance movement, only because being 100 pounds over what would be a good body mass index is a health risk. It just is a health risk. So I'm really not okay with making that. You see, it's a double-edged sword, body acceptance. But if you're 100 pounds overweight, I know as a surgeon what it takes to operate on someone of that size. And it's not easy. It's not healthy. But the paradox is you still have to accept where you are now in order to change anything.
Does it make a difference if a woman who is overweight changes her diet with the goal of creating as much health as possible for herself rather than with the goal of changing what the scale says?
Yes. Yes. That is exactly right. Now we go back to Louise Hay. Changes that are loved into being are permanent. Changes that are forced into being, you'll constantly have to force them into being. You know, it's kind of like being whipped into shape or wanting to go exercise. You know, if you think about, let's think about your average family dog, right? You get the leash out, the dog goes nuts. Oh my God, we're going for a walk. We get to go out and exercise. Yay. Or little kids the same way. I picked up my granddaughter at school yesterday and she said, I want to stay outside and play. I left my snowsuit at school. Fine, you can stay outside and play. It doesn't matter. I mean, that's who we really are. We are the dog who wants to go out and be in the fresh air. And over time, this is like resetting those taste buds that I talked about with David Ludwig's program. You know, for 2 weeks, nothing sweet until you reset your taste buds. And same with movement, exercise, walking, any of those things. It might take you a month of just doing it through sheer will every day. But then the magic happens where you want to do it, where you can't stop yourself from doing it. That's the ultimate goal. And that's what any mammal would want.
Well, I sometimes think that we don't get enough credit, and I'm referring to men and women both here, that for taking care of ourselves, for taking care of our health. We're taught to put other things ahead of our own well-being. And when we take steps to heal ourselves and to create healthy lifestyles, we can feel out of step with society. We can feel almost guilty about it. Like it's not real work. It's self-indulgent.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. You know, there's a phrase that Esther Hicks says, you can't get sick enough to help those who are sick, and you can't get poor enough to help those who are poor. And there's no question. You know, now we're back to the tribes wounding their members with betrayal, abandonment, and shaming. I remember years ago, I was asked to come down and do a workshop at a conference center in Massachusetts. And it was an old kind of hippy-dippy place, you know, with VW buses in the woods and all kinds of things. And I walk in there and this woman comes up to me and she goes, well, I can tell you're not from here. You take care of yourself. You know, it's like, you don't look like a ragamuffin. You don't look like you just got dragged out from under a rock. So therefore, you take care of yourself, meaning you don't belong. So you have to, and by the way, that kind of thing happens in families all the time. Who do you think you are? You know, because everyone, it's the old misery loves company. So again, we go back to, you need to find the birds of a feather who support you in becoming all that you can be. I was just recently meeting with a world-renowned poet, and we were talking about the fact that his success is often met with derision from fellow poets who are not as successful. So we just have to see that part of human nature, accept it, love them, and move on. But there's no question that it is painful. It's painful when someone doesn't love you unless you're struggling, unless you're suffering, unless you're overweight, unless you're unhappy. You know, that's how a lot of people socialize these days. I call it the organ recitals, you know, where they're talking about, well, this is what my doctor said, and my liver is this, and my kidneys are that, and my blood pressure, and now I'm on this medication. I mean, you probably know the average 65-year-old now is on 6 prescription medications a day. So this becomes the new normal, but I comfort myself by saying it doesn't take too many of us who are shining the light in a very different way to change everything.
Well, I appreciate that very much. I remember when I was a child and I was trying to eat more healthfully, but still relate to my parents who ate just mountains of ice cream. They literally, I did as a child, eat ice cream for breakfast. I mean, it was more probably than most people could even imagine. And it was just an ice cream diet, an ice cream centered diet. And I wanted to stop doing that. And I knew I needed to go cold turkey. I needed to stop eating sweets entirely in order to regain and re-own my taste buds. But I wasn't received real well. I remember my mother once saying, what do you think, you're better than us?
And she did?
She did.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. And it had nothing to do with that. I was trying to be healthier. And so I felt I had to kind of pull away from engaging with her around the topic because she always was shaming and belittling me. And that wasn't helping me. So I needed to detach with as much compassion and love as I could so that I could find people to be my new family who could reflect who I really was and understand me.
That's right. Did you ever make peace with your family, with your mother and father?
I did, particularly with my father. He was actually easier for me, despite the fact that he was the one so identified with the ice cream business. But yes, I did. More with my dad than I would have ever believed possible, actually, because of his belief systems were so different than my own. But we found in the end that blood was thicker than ice cream, actually.
That's a great line. Oh, man.
He came to have a lot of respect for what I was doing. Actually, what happened was he developed a lot of medical problems. He developed seriously high blood pressure and very advanced diabetes. And he had a heart condition that was his heart was in very bad shape. And his prognosis was very, very poor. And one day his cardiologist leveled with him and said, if you continue the way you're going, the best we can do is juggle your medications and try to control some of the side effects that are bothering you. But really all we can do is make your few remaining years a little more comfortable, unless you really want to do something different and really change your life. And then maybe there'd be a different prognosis possible for you. And he handed him a copy of my first book, Diet for a New America, not even knowing that the
really?
Robins...
Yeah, really? Yeah. Oh my God, I he love that. That's, oh God.
And my poor father, he knew that book was written by his maverick son that had rejected his life work. And he just didn't say a word. He took the book. Now, he already had a copy. I had given him one. I sent him an autographed copy when it came out. He didn't read it. But now that the high priest of Western medicine gave him a copy of my book and said he should read it. Now he read it. I'm sure he read the copy the doctor gave him, not the one I sent him. But in any event, he did, and he started to make changes. He got results. He made more changes. He got more results. His blood pressure resolved. He didn't need those meds that they told him he'd have to take for the rest of his life. And the side effects went away. His diabetes, stunningly, began to reverse and eventually completely reverse. He no longer needed insulin. He no longer needed diabetic pills. There was no longer talk of blindness or amputation of a foot or a leg, which had been under discussion before. He lived another 20 really healthy years, and he attributed that in many ways to my work. And he would say, it's unbelievable. It's incredible. It turns out you were right.
You know what? Most of us never live to see that. So
no.
That's a wonderful, how wonderful. Don't you feel the karma in that? That, you know, you chose this family and that was going to be the baseline. You know, you're kind of brought up in a family that's the American dream on steroids. And then you grow out of that something to heal the damage done by what seems like such a great idea at the beginning.
Yes. Yes. And to feel the reconciliation with my dad, the rapprochement was really, really heartwarming and healing for me. And I didn't expect it. I didn't know that that would happen. I didn't think it would, actually. I found it extremely unlikely that it would, but it did. And I think writ large, in my case, what was a process that a lot of us go through, where we want to honor ourselves, take care of ourselves, be true to our essence, be true to our purposes for taking life, commit to the highest vibration of which we're possible and ever-expanding connections to life and to ourselves and to each other with as much love as we can muster. And yet, we live in a society that pushes us very often in a different direction.
It absolutely, yeah, it does.
It does. And one of the things I love about your work across the board through your books, through all your books on their different topics, is that you help us through your transparency and your wisdom, help us to see what the next step could be to reclaim our power, to reclaim our wisdom, to reclaim our connections with each other.
That is absolutely true. I recently watched that amazing documentary called Tomorrow, or it originally was in French, Demain. You might have seen it, where this group of people who were devastated by climate change and what would happen to their children decided to go and see what people were doing that was working, you know, instead of the doom and gloom. Come on, let's just see. Because, you know, one of the things they said that I love is human beings, we're so good at the movies about doomsday and apocalypse and the end of the world. We're kind of terrible at what could the new thing look like? Like, how cool could it be? And so they went to places like Detroit and all these urban farms that people are doing in Detroit. I mean, the last time I was in Detroit, it was like going through the bombing of Beirut. Well, that isn't even there anymore. There's urban gardens everywhere. They're trying to become a food sovereign city. And this kind of thing is happening all over the planet. But you never hear about it in the mainstream media, because remember that the mainstream media, as far as I can tell, is owned by giant energy vampires. And their food is anger and fear. And so they keep you hooked on anger and fear and outrage, and so that you eat more of the junk food that the same people produce. And that's the way it is.
And then you need more drugs.
And then you need more drugs. That's the other thing. Yeah, then you need more drugs. And, you know, remember what I said, the average 65-year-old is on 6 prescription drugs every day. And I shake my head. I have a friend, Gladys McGarry, who I think is about to celebrate her 99th birthday. But when she was 93, she used to give lectures. She's a physician. And she'd start with 93 and prescription free. And my mother is 94, just got her driver's license renewed till 100. And she's not on a single prescription medication. So I think people need to choose role models who are not what everyone believes. By the way, do you know the number of people over 65 who are actually in nursing homes? It's only 4%. But you would think, right, from all the ads on television, remember, the US and New Zealand are the only nations where they allow direct-to-consumer pharmaceutical ads on television. And 70% of the news and mainstream network television is brought to you by Big Pharma. So it's just important to know who's bringing you the news. Because basically, the news these days, as far as I can tell, is nothing but advertisements for Big Pharma and what they want you to think. And because it's depressing, they want to get everyone on antidepressants. So anyhow.
Well, we have a sickness industry. We call it healthcare.
No, it's not.
It's not. It's disease management. And
yep.
And if you aren't diseased, then you're not a market. And they can't make money off you. So there is an incentive there for you to be sick. And we have to resist that. I want to ask you one last question, Christian. It's about a study. I want to describe the study and get your response to it. I think you're probably familiar with it. It was done at Ohio State University, and it was done on cardiovascular disease in rabbits. Now, studies like this can strike me as ethically dubious, because as in this case, the rabbits had been bred to develop atherosclerosis and coronary artery disease. And then the rabbits were fed a diet deliberately designed to accelerate that disease process. So the investigators were literally trying to make these rabbits develop clogged arteries as fast as possible.
Right, right.
And then the rabbits were killed and autopsied. And I'm not a fan of these kinds of experiments, but at the end of the study, when the rabbits were killed, the researchers were stunned because they found that about 15% or so of the rabbits had almost no coronary artery disease. Their arteries were clean, while all the other rabbits had developed severe artery disease, as expected.
You're right.
And it took a while for the researchers to figure out what had happened. Christian, can you tell us what they eventually realized and why this is important?
Yes. I love this study so much. I mean, I remember, you know, pulling this study, having it in my files, you know, the famous Ohio State rabbit study.
Yes.
And they
yes.
repeated the study three times with the same results every time because they couldn't believe it. And then they discovered that a female graduate student was feeding the rabbits, that was her job, every night. And the rabbits who had the clean arteries were at waist level. So she would open their cages and pet and play with them before feeding them because they happened to be right there in her line of sight. And she could play with them and pet them. And those were the rabbits three different times that had clean arteries. So what I used to say when I'd give lectures on food is that if you're going to eat junky food, get a massage.
Or better yet, eat healthy food and get a massage
and
give one as well. And, you know, when I talk with you, there's a phrase that comes to mind, which is that whenever a woman gets healthier and happier, she heals herself and she heals her family and she heals the earth. There's something about your work that phrase reflects to me.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, I think that is true. Women are the ones who give birth. Women are closer to the earth than are most men, not all. And, you know, there's a phrase, happy wife, happy life. And so when women embrace happiness as a path, as a spiritual path, when they embrace fun, when they embrace pleasure, when they embrace their power, but also when they embrace their fierce mother bear energy, when they see the innocence of someone that is threatened, either their own or someone else's innocence, then to remain healthy, we must say something. And when you do, and it comes from that place that's rooted in the mother bear and in the earth, then it uplifts everybody and it strengthens everybody. I think it's because it's like having your own mother archetypally stand up for you when there's a bully on the playground. Or in my own case, I took piano lessons way back and we went for a recital. And a younger student than me, my teacher actually shamed me in front of the whole audience. She asked another student what she thought of my playing, and the other student said, "I thought she did very well." And my teacher said, "I think Miriam is being very generous with you." I mean, she said that in front of everybody. We leave, and my mother says to me, "You never need to come back here again."
Oh, bless your mother.
Like, nobody is going to shame my kid.
Well, bless her for standing. You know, that's loving fierceness. You know, Christian, my day is always brightened when I get to talk to you, and it's also deepened. Your aliveness, your joy, your wisdom, your loving fierceness are all lights to my heart as they are to the hearts of our world. And on behalf of Ocean and myself and everyone involved in the food revolution and everyone who lives in a human body, I thank you for your deeply informed voice, your message of joy and love and caring, and of course, for being with us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure always.
We've been talking with Dr. Christian Northrup, a best-selling author of many fabulous books, including the newly revised Women's Bodies, Women's Wisdom. Christian, this has been such a beautiful conversation. Your work to understand and to articulate the emotional, psychological, and spiritual dimensions of health is medicine for the body, for the heart, and for the soul. We thank you so much for your exquisite insight, for your brilliant leadership, and for your partnership in the food revolution.
Thank you.